Right, should I pick it up?
So my dissertation's basically, it was kind of inspired by watching, during the first series of Comedy Vehicle, I watched a few clips of you on YouTube.
Oh, right.
And it was one of you opening in Montreal with the, how you got off hard drugs.
Oh, that joke, yeah, I've done that joke for 20 years. Well,
yeah.
I don't do it anymore, actually, but I used to open every... It was the sort of opening gag in, like, the first set I ever did. And, weirdly, often the first set you ever write is the one... The opening 10 minutes of it are all the, like, jokes that say sort of who you are and what your angle is in a really neat little form.
Mm.
And it's quite hard to ever... Like, and when you go around the world and you're asked to do other stuff, you often have to go back to that set because it's the one that sort of introduces you. And I used to direct the Mighty Boosh as a live thing, and I used to get terribly frustrated by the fact that every show I'd always be saying to them, you've got to go back to your opening 10 minutes, you've got to do them somehow, because they said who they are, and then, oh, we've moved on, but you have to kind of, no one knows who most of us are, you know, and you always have to do this thing. And the funny thing about that joke was when I wrote it as a teenager, I thought it was really sort of hard-hitting and making a clever satirical point.
Yeah.
It was actually as a result of a friend of mine who was a born-again Christian. She'd gone and worked for this charity in Hong Kong that got some people off heroin by getting them into evangelical Christianity. Which seemed to... anyway, when I was a kid, I thought it was really like, yeah, stick it to that, that's shown you.
Mm.
Whereas by the end, I just thought it was a sort of absurd thing to say. Especially, you know, it just seemed... it seemed just really glib, and I quite found that quite funny in itself.
Yeah.
So I hope that wasn't.
That's
fine. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah, and then just how when you, I think it was in the religion episode when you opened it again.
Yeah.
And you immediately addressed it that you'd that
oh,
was an old joke.
Right. Right.
20 years ago. That's kind of when it clicked for me because I've seen people like Jack D, and I saw him in Milton Keynes, and I saw him in Bedford.
Yeah.
And he opened up with the same line about the local area.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I saw him on the Apollo, and he said almost the same thing
yeah.
as well. And it was just how a lot of stand-up kind of ignores the fact that it's a lot of it's like hidden repetitions.
Yeah. Well, I think it's one thing to pretend something spontaneous, which is what Jack D is doing, and another thing to do a piece of material more than once, right? Obviously, you're going to do that. Some people do the same piece of material for their whole lives, and before television, you know, there was... Wilson, Keppel and Betty, the famous music hall act, toured a 7-minute amusing dance called the Sand Dance for about 50 years, you know, and it was really funny,
yeah.
But, so it is different. I mean, I think the, what I'd quite like to do is expose the mechanisms of things anyway, so doing that bit on telly, I just thought, I'll say that I've done this for that long. Also, the other thing these days is you get picked apart by nerds on the internet, which you never used to be. Often, something that they go, oh, I saw that 3 years ago in an open mic night in up to 12 people in a pub in Chelmsford, you know, and it's all like, oh, come on. But the thing Jack D's doing about every town, I had stuff about, like, Bob Monkhouse said you could open in any town by criticising their one-way system, because all people like to think it's sort of
yeah.
unique to their
yeah.
town. But you go, sorry I'm late, I got in the one-way system. You know, ah, brilliant. They think you've done something with the actual town. What I find is if you do notice two things on the way in, the name of a museum or something, and you mention those, people just think they love it,
yeah.
right? I also found you can attack any town aggressively, and people really like it, just say it's the worst place you've ever been, except for Birmingham, where people had a sense that it wasn't very good, really, so they were sort of defensive about it. Whereas in other places, there actually is enough sort of civic pride for people to, they quite like it. And particularly if you go to a place like Glasgow or Belfast, where you're English and you're supposed to be treading on eggshells,
mm.
and if you go to a place like that and are abusive in detail about very culturally specific things, they're so impressed that they're kind of won over.
Yeah.
It's sort of, it's the opposite of ingratiating yourself. It's
yeah.
a bit like laying down the rules. But certainly those hack comics like Jack D and Bob Monkhouse, they've normally got a set of stock things that would work for any town.
Mm.
Yeah.
So, by would you say that like exposing it kind of helps negate the fact that a lot of stuff is kind of, you know, a lot of sets are getting archived and recorded and
Yeah, although again with me, like, if you look at that, is that Canadian guy who does loads of Stuart Francis, right? Stuart Francis has done the same 7 minutes on Des O'Connor. He's done it on Live at the Apollo. He's done it, like, there's five or six versions of doing the same thing. Since 2004, I've tended to turn over a new 90 minutes every year, and I don't repeat it, right? There was about a 20 minute overlap in 3 hours of the last television series with stuff that I'd done before. Usually I did it because it just fitted, like, the narrative of that show really well or whatever. And even that stuff, when it had been done before, it was usually done quite differently. And by done before, I mean recorded before, yeah. You know, broadcast anywhere or recorded. So I don't think it really sticks to me, that sort of thing. There's not many comics that have the turnover of material that I do. Daniel Kitson, Richard Herring, who I used to work with, probably, although he does more like monologues, really, like theatre shows. So I'm not a great example of that. Doing the same thing again and making a mistake. Like, normally, sometimes people. Are you coming to this show?
I was thinking of doing it because I've already seen it.
Have you? Oh, you've seen that, right?
I thought it might be interesting to see it again.
Well, I'll get you a ticket tonight if you want. But in this, there's a bit that is a bit like a bit I used to do on the IRA in 2004, but it's like three times as long now. And there's a thing that I've done where in the last touring live show, which is on DVD, I did a sort of 40-minute story about Richard Hammond, and then at the end of it said that story isn't true. I'm doing the same thing now with like a 20-minute story about David Cameron, 15 okay. minutes. And I end it exactly the same way. I think I wanted a way of doing something like that on television, but it's not like repeating it. It's actually, I think it might be a thing that I'll do. It's just for the future. It's just tell.
I thought it kind of, because it kind of works, because I think stand up in itself is kind of false in a way.
Yeah.
Because it's like you're kind of feigning this narrative, which is based on an improvised conversation, which normally would happen between two people.
Yeah,
and it's just one person delivering.
Yeah, well,
so I think you can kind of.
Well, the other problem with improvisation is like, it's like, again, to keep things alive for myself, I try and build in bits that will be different every night, like that IRA bit can go differently the way I take it. But by the end of a tour, when you've done it 100 times, you get to the point where every single possible avenue has been explored, really, and so it does start to become a succession of learned choices. Hopefully, we're doing 2 months here and then recording the telly, I'll hit the ground at just the point when I come to record these shows where there's still a genuine fluidity in it,
yeah.
A genuine uncertainty about things. I hope so, but it sort of is inevitable. I mean, this improvising guitarist I used to like, Derek Bailey, he got to the point where he liked to pair himself off with people that he knew nothing about and he'd never even heard and didn't even know if he would like them. Because he said that the sort of, he could recognise the styles and approaches of other European jazz improvisers to the point where it was kind of intuitively he'd know where he was going. Whereas if you put him down with a drum and bass bloke, or a Japanese avant-garde noise guitarist, or a tap dancer, or whatever, he didn't really understand them. Therefore, he got better work out of it. So it's sort of like trying to trick yourself into not knowing where you're going,
yeah.
and trying to forget what you know, actually, and like I try to improvise myself into a corner to see what will happen.
Yeah.
But even the problem with that now is that what I can do is I can just go, oh, I've improvised myself into a corner, and then people laugh, and then you're out of it again. You know, it's increasingly difficult to fail.
Yeah.
Now, particularly people that come and see me, a lot of them know who I am and like me. Mm. You know.
That's the other thing with the improvisation. I know you're a fan of jazz and stuff, aren't you?
Yeah.
And like, I was thinking about jazz as well, because that's something which is a lot of the time it's kind of sold as an improvised performance.
Yeah, so yeah.
It's always there's some solid structure there behind, like the rhythm section or something.
Sometimes, well, there is in a lot of, there is in jazz, in free jazz there isn't so much, and in free improvisation. But what I like about that, and where I think it overlaps with comedy, is if you listen to like 50s things like Sonny Rollins or John Coltrane, particularly when John Coltrane's doing a really familiar tune, like My Favourite Things by Rodgers and Hammerstein from The Sound of Music, everyone knows that. So we'll go, get it out of the way in 30 seconds, do like 40 minutes of like, you don't know where it's going. But what's hanging over you is the fact that eventually, because it's a show tune, it will return to a main theme.
Yeah.
And the point where it comes back in, I just find that absolutely joyous. And I kind of think that's the thing about a joke, right, is we all know the structure of a joke. Basically goes, na 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 where the fun is how you expand or contract that middle bit, right? And someone like Jimmy Carr, love him or hate him, his kind of thing is he can get jokes down to about 5 words.
Yeah.
Like a 2-word setup and a 3-word punchline. That's his thing, right? One of the things I like is I like the audience almost to have guessed what the punchline is going to be.
Yeah, like one of...
Telegraph it and then see... How much fun you can have with the journey. You know?
It's like, I was saying to a friend, like, my favourite joke of yours is when you say now.
Yeah, well.
It's like. Yeah.
You know what? Someone pointed that out to me. A friend of mine said, that's your catchphrase, going now. Right. And then you get the laugh because people have realised that you're going to just change everything you just said.
Mm.
And in a way, I wish you hadn't pointed it out to me because I'm self aware. You're the second person to have said that, or your friend or whatever. And in a way, I'm now aware of that. And there's a point where I do it in this show, and I realise that I've been doing it for years. But now, I know that I'm doing it, and it's really itself a bit... It's self-conscious, which is really sad, actually, because it was one of the last instinctive things that were left, was not knowing that. And now's the hinge, right? You say now, and then after that, they kind of anticipate the area, if not the specifics, of what you're going to say. So, yeah.
What do you feel about people who are less self-aware, like comedians? Because I don't know. I was watching a documentary yesterday about American stand-ups, and I really detested them all afterwards. But like, they all seem to just go out and just have this material, and it's all just.
Well, it's a very different. First of all, it's a very different culture, America, right? Here, because we had publicly funded arts centres and all sorts of things in the 80s. This thing started to happen with stand-up here after 1980, after alternative comedy started, whereby if you could get an hour together and give it a name and come back with another hour in a couple of years' time with a different name, you could get on this sort of art centre touring circuit, 100, 200, 300 seater rooms, 30 dates. And before Michael McIntyre and doing gigs at the O2 was a twinkle in anyone's eye, there was this sort of thing of like a just about a sustainable thing, right? Whereas, so lots of comics, there were two kinds of comics basically, and say until 3 or 4 years ago, you'd go to Edinburgh and you'd be trying to get this hour together, and then you'd hope in the fringe that someone would go, I'll promote that around these sorts of places. Or you got your tight 20 and you did Comedy Store and Jongleurs, maybe the same 20 for 20 years, 30 years, until you gave up or died, right? 5 nights a week in these commercial venues, you make 50 grand a year out of it, fine, right? But in America, the model's completely different. In America, most acts haven't got, even acts you've heard of, haven't really got more than 30, 35 minutes. They don't think in terms of structured shows. There isn't that mid-scale thing, they haven't got that kind of art centre circuit, they don't really have publicly funded spaces. And when the big ones tour, they're touring maybe in a package. When you see these concert films of Chris Rock or Bill Hicks doing an hour and a quarter and it's about something, it's absolutely the exception, not the rule. What they're mainly trying to do over there is get the 7 minutes they do in the clubs, you only do about 7 minutes in most of the clubs, down to 2.5 that they could do on Letterman, right? So they don't, on the whole, it's not their fault. They're not in a culture that encourages them to develop. They're in a culture that encourages them to pare it all back to a simple number of immediately recognisable character traits, which might then get them apart as that character in a sitcom built around them. That's basically the career model in America. It's totally different to here and to Australia and New Zealand even. So it's kind of blown it really. They're mainly shit.
Yeah.
And it's not their fault. They're not being They're not, there isn't a thing. There isn't. All right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sorry. There isn't. So there isn't really a. There isn't really a culture around them to support it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, because they just all seem like cartoon characters in the same
way. Yeah, it's funny, isn't it?
Yeah. What about stuff like when you... these are all my notes. When you script, like, kind of have scripted failure, like when a joke... When you're performing a joke that isn't finished, like the Michael McIntyre
yeah.
style joke.
Yeah.
Well,
The interesting thing about that is that last show, 41st, what was it called, the last one? The Firm World Comedian. It kind of was the second half of it working was sort of predicated on me failing to do observational comedy, and also on there being some sort of struggle with the audience, at least half of whom normally wouldn't accept that Top Gear was of no value, right? So then that means you're on a bit of a sticky wicket. You're on the defensive. Good thing about, there's a lot of bollocks written about what you can and can't make jokes about. Chris Rock said you can make a joke about anything if you're applying pressure upwards, right, and not applying pressure downwards, which means that Jerry Sadovitz, looking like a social outcast, bouffinard, Mr. Punch misfit, can sort of push up against anything, because he's like an outsider, bottom of the pile, whereas Frankie Boyle, making the jokes about the same people, is a man in an Armani suit in a 4,000 seat stadium, applying pressure downwards, so it kind of depends where you're coming from. And how I got a lot of that show to work was, now that I'm more of a success and I'm doing bigger rooms, I kind of have to manufacture a struggle or my own failure in order to allow me to be applying pressure upwards. Otherwise I'm like Frankie Boyle, I'm like one of these guys, like a bully, right? The weird thing about that show was it normally worked, but at the very end of